exactly are you concerned with Link and his thugs and me having some fun with them? Because I'm Homicide. He whips open a file and shows me an 8x10 color photo of two dead bodies in some sort of trash heap. They're lying face down with their wrists tied tightly behind them. The backs of their necks are caked with dried blood.
Found these two stiffs in the city landfill, wrapped in an old piece of shag carpet. The bulldozer shoved it down a small embankment, and Tubby and Razor rolled out. Tubby is Danny Fango, on the right there. Razor, on the left, is Arthur Robilio.
He shuffles the deck and pulls out another 8x10. The two bodies have been rearranged and are lying face up, side by bloody side. The black boot of a cop is in the picture, next to the mangled head of good old Tubby. Their throats have been cut wide and deep. Reardon says,
"Each got two slugs back of the head. That plus a switchblade from ear to ear. Does it every time. So far, clean killings. No prints, ballistics, forensics. Probably a common gang thing. No big loss to society, know what I mean?"
My stomach flips as acid fills my throat. There is a strong urge to vomit, along with a lightheadedness that could mean a quick faint. I turn away from the photos, shake my head in disgust, and tell myself to try, if humanly possible, to act unconcerned. I manage to shrug and say, "So what, Reardon? You think I rubbed these guys out because they jumped me in the courthouse?"
"I don't know what I'm thinking right now, but I got these two Boy Scouts on the slab, and nobody knows nothing. As far as I know, you were the last person to get in a fight with them. You seem to enjoy operating down in the gutter. Maybe you got some friends down there. One thing leads to another."
"You can't even sell that to yourself, Reardon. Weak as water. Go accuse somebody else because you're wasting time with me. I don't kill. I just defend killers."
"Same thing if you ask me. I'll keep digging."
He leaves, and I find a toilet. I lock the stall door, sit on the lid, and ask myself if it's possible. Chapter 18. We park the U-Haul in a slot at a hot dog drive-in and order sodas from a cutie on skates. Neither of us has an appetite. She brings the drinks and partner rolls up the window, by hand, the old-fashioned way. He takes a long sip and, staring straight ahead, says,
"No way, boss. I made myself real clear. Scare 'em, but don't touch 'em. Nobody gets hurt."
"They're not in pain," I say.
"But, boss, you gotta understand how things work in the gutter. Say Miguel and his boys track down Tubby and Razor and manage to create a confrontation. They make threats, but let's say Tubby and Razor are not bothered by threats. Hell, they've been making them for 30 years. They don't appreciate the intrusion and let it be known. Miguel has to stand his ground. Words get heated, more threats are made, and at some point things get out of hand. Takes just one punch to start a brawl, and before long, somebody pulls a gun or a knife."
"I want you to talk to Miguel."
"Why? He'll never admit it, boss. Never."
I sip through the straw and force down the beverage. Everything seems to be locked up, from throat to bowels. After a long gap, I say, "We're assuming it's Miguel. It could be someone else. Tubby and Razor have spent a career breaking arms. Maybe they pushed the wrong guy this time." Partner nods and manages a weak,
"Could be."
Chapter 19. I'm awake at 3:37 a.m. when my cell phone begins vibrating. Slowly, I pick it up. Caller unknown, the worst kind. With great reluctance, I say,
"Hello."
I'd recognize the voice anywhere.
"This Rudd?"
he asks.
"It is. Who's calling?"
"Your old client, Swanger. Arch Swanger."
"I was hoping I'd never hear from you again."
"I don't miss you either, but we gotta talk. Since you can't be trusted and don't hesitate to sacrifice your clients, I'm assuming your phone is tapped and the cops are listening."
"Nope."
"You're a liar, Rudd." Fine, hang up and don't call me back.
Not that simple. We gotta talk. That girl is alive, Rudd, and bad things are going on.
I don't care.
There's an all-night pharmacy at the corner of Preston and 15th. Buy some shaving cream. Behind a can of Gillette menthol, you'll find a small black phone, prepaid. Take it, but don't get caught shoplifting. Call the number on the screen. It's me. I'll wait 30 minutes, then I'm leaving town. Got it, Rudd?
No. I'm not playing this time, Swanger.
The girl is alive, Rudd, and you can bring her back. Just like you rescued your kid, now you can be the real hero. If not, she'll be dead in a year. It's all you, buddy.
Why should I believe you, Swanger?
Because I know the truth. I may not always tell the truth, but I know what's going on with the Kemp girl. It ain't pretty. Come on, Rudd. Play along. Don't call your thug and don't use that goofy U-Haul van. Seriously? What kind of lawyer are you?
The line goes dead, and I lie on my back and stare at the ceiling. If Arch Swanger is on the run, and I know for a fact that he is because he's number one on our cop's most wanted list, Link Scanlon being number two, then how in the world could he know that I'm buzzing around town these days in a rented van? And how could he purchase and hide a prepaid cell phone? 20 minutes later, I park in front of the pharmacy and wait until two winos move away from the front door. This is a sketchy part of town, and it's not clear why this company, a national chain, would select this neighborhood for an all-night drugstore. I walk inside and see no one except for the clerk, who's flipping through a tabloid. I find the shaving cream and the phone, which I quickly stick into a pocket. I pay for the shaving cream, and as I drive away, I punch in the number. Swanger answers with,
"Just keep driving. Hit the interstate and go north."
"To where, Swanger?"
"To me. I want to look you in the eyes and ask you why you told the cops where I buried the girl."
"Maybe I don't want to talk about it."
"You will."
"Why did you lie, Swanger?"
"It was just a test to see if you can be trusted. Obviously, you cannot. I want to know why."
"And I want to know why you can't leave me alone."
"Because I need a lawyer, Rudd, plain and simple. What am I supposed to do? Take the elevator up to the 40th floor and confide in a guy in a black suit who charges $1,000 an hour? Or maybe call one of those bozos you see on the billboards begging for bankruptcies and car wrecks? I need a real guy from the streets, Rudd, a real slime ball who knows how to play dirty. Right now, you're the man."
"No, I'm not."
"Take the White Bluff exit off the interstate and go east for 2 miles. There's an all-night burger joint currently advertising a double patty melt with real Velveeta cheese. Yum, yum. I'll watch you go in and take a seat. I'll make sure you're alone and nobody's following you. When I walk in, you won't recognize me at first."
"I'll be packing some heat, Swanger, permit and all, and I know how to use it. Nothing funny, okay?"
"No need for that, I swear."
"Swear all you want to, but I don't believe a word you say."
"Makes two of us."
Chapter 20. There is a lack of ventilation, and the air is thick with the smell of greasy burgers and fries. I buy a coffee and sit at a table in the center for 10 minutes as two drunk teenagers in a booth giggle and talk with their mouths full. In a far corner, an obese, elderly couple gorge themselves as if they'll never see food again. Part of this joint's marketing brilliance is that the entire menu is half price from midnight to 6 a.m. That and the Velveeta. A man in a brown UPS uniform enters and does not look around. He buys a soft drink and some fries and is suddenly seated across from me. Behind round, frameless glasses, I finally recognize Swanger's eyes.
"Glad you could make it," he says, barely audible.
"A real pleasure," I say. "Cute uniform."
"It works. Here's what's happening, Rudd. Juliana Kemp is very much alive, but I'm sure she wishes she were dead. She had her baby a few months back. They sold it for $50,000, on the high end. The range, I'm told, is 25 to 50 for a little Caucasian thing from good stock. The darker ones go cheaper."
"Who is they?"
"We'll get to it in a minute. Right now, She's working long hours as a stripper and hooker in a sex club 1,000 miles away. She's basically a slave, owned by some nasty types who've got her hooked on heroin. That's why she can't leave, and that's why she'll do whatever she's told. Don't suppose you've ever dealt with human trafficking? No. Don't ask how I got involved. A long, sad story. I really don't care, Swanger. I'd like to help the girl, but I'm not sticking my nose into it. You said you needed a lawyer. He picks up a single fry and examines it as if looking for poison, then slowly puts it into his mouth. He glares at me from behind the fake lenses and finally says, "She'll work the clubs for a bit, then they'll decide to breed her again. They pass her around, you know, and when she gets pregnant, they'll get her off the drugs and lock her away. The baby's got to be healthy, you know. She's one of 8 or 10 girls on their payroll, mostly white, but a few brown ones, all from this country."
"All abducted?"
"Of course. You don't think they volunteered?"
I don't know what to think. I hope he's lying, but something tells me he's not. Either way, the story is so repulsive, I can only shake my head. I can't help but see the images of Roy Kemp and his wife on the news pleading for a safe return of their daughter.
"Real tragic," I say. "But I'm losing patience here, Swanger. First, I can't believe anything you say. Second, you said you needed a lawyer. Why did you tell the cops where she was buried?"
"Because they kidnapped my son and forced me to cough up what you told me." He likes this story and can't hold back a smile.
"Really? The cops kidnapped your son?"
"They did. I caved, told them. They raced out to the site, wasted an entire night digging, and when it became apparent you were lying, they released my kid." He crams 3 fries into his mouth and chomps like he's working an entire pack of bubble gum.
"I was in the woods watching, laughing my ass off at those clowns. I was also cussing you for telling my secret."
"You're a sicko, Swanger. Why am I here?"
"Because I need money, Rudd. It ain't easy living on the run like this. You wouldn't believe some of the shit I have to do to generate cash, and I'm sick of it. There's about 150 grand in reward money sitting in a pot somewhere in the police department. I figure if I can get the girl back to her family, then I should get some of the money."
I don't know why I'm shocked by this. Nothing this idiot says should surprise me. I take a deep breath and say, "Allow me to make some sense of this. You kidnapped the girl 1 year ago. The good people of our city donated their cash for a reward fund. Now you, the kidnapper, would like to return the girl, and for this act of great humanity, you think you should get some of the reward money, the same money now being held to solve the crime you committed. Right, Swanger?"
"I got no problem with that.
It works on all fronts.
They get the girl, I get the cash.
More of a ransom deal, I think."
"Call it what you like, I don't care. I just gotta have some cash, Rudd, and I figure a lawyer like you can make it happen."
I jump to my feet and say,
"What you need is a bullet, Swanger." "Where are you going?"
"Home, and if you call me again, I'll call the cops."
"I'm sure you will."
Our volume has increased, and the drunk teenagers are staring at us. I walk away and manage to get outside before he catches me and grabs my shoulder.
"You think I'm lying about the girl, don't you, Rudd?"
I quickly grab the Glock 19 from the holster under my left armpit and grip it with my right hand. I back away as he freezes, staring at the pistol. I say,
"I don't know if you're lying, and I don't care. You're a sick puppy, Swanger, and I'm sure you'll die an awful death. Now leave me alone."
He relaxes and smiles.
"You ever hear of a town called Lamont, Missouri?" "No reason to, really. Podunk place of 1,000 people, an hour north of Columbia. 3 nights ago, a 20-year-old girl, first name of Heather, disappeared. The whole town's in a panic. Everybody's in on the search, stomping through the woods and looking under bushes. No sign whatsoever. She's all right, I mean at least she's alive. She's living in the same warehouse with Juliana Kemp, West Central Chicago, getting the same abuse. Check it out online, Rudd. The Columbia paper ran a small story this morning. Just another girl, this one 500 miles away, but these guys are hardcore traffickers."
I grip the pistol even tighter and resist the urge to raise it shoulder high, and and put a couple into his skull. Part 6. The Plea. Chapter 1. Jury selection in the trial of Tadeo Zapata begins on Monday. It will be a circus because the press is giddy with anticipation and the courthouse is buzzing. The YouTube video of Tadeo laying waste to the referee Sean King has over 60 million hits. Our fearless action news heroes show it repeatedly during the evening and morning broadcasts. Same video, same drivel, same grim shaking of heads, as if it just can't be believed. It seems as though everyone has an opinion, and few of them favor my client. On three occasions I have asked the court for a change of venue, and all three requests have been quickly rejected. 200 prospective jurors have been summoned for Monday, and it will be fascinating to see how many claim to have no knowledge of the case. Right now, though, it's Friday, around midnight, and I'm lying naked under the sheets with Ms. Naomi Tarrant close by. She is sleeping, purring in long, deep breaths, dead to the world. Our second session began around 10, after pizza and beer, and though it lasted for less than half an hour, it was nonetheless thrilling and utterly exhausting. We both admit that we've been a bit on the inactive side, and we're having a grand time catching up. I have no idea where this nascent relationship might be headed, and I'm always overcautious, a result, no doubt, of the permanent damage inflicted by Judith. But as of right now, I adore this girl and would like to see her as often as possible, naked or otherwise. I wish I could sleep like that. She's in a coma, and I'm lying here wide awake, not aroused, that would be normal, but thinking of so many things other than sex. The trial Monday, Swanger and his tale about the Kemp girl, the bloody bodies of Tubby and Razor rolled up in old cheap carpet and dumped in the landfill, probably by Miguel Zapata and his gang of drug dealers. I think of Detective Reardon and almost shudder at the idea that he and others in the police department suspect, either slightly or strongly, that I had something to do with the murders of Link's thugs. I wonder if Link has decided to leave me alone, now that I can snap my fingers and get people whacked. So many thoughts, so many problems. I'm tempted to ease out of bed and go find some booze. Then I remember that Naomi doesn't keep the stuff in her apartment. She's a light drinker and a healthy eater, and she does yoga 4 days a week to keep things superbly toned. I don't want to wake her, so I lie still and stare at her back, at the smooth, perfect skin that rises and falls over her shoulder blades and lifts again to form the cutest bottom I've ever seen. She's 33 years old, recently divorced from a creep she wasted 7 years with, childless and seemingly unconcerned by it. She doesn't talk much about her past, but I know she has suffered greatly. Her first love was her college boyfriend, who was killed by a drunk driver a month before their wedding date. With moist eyes, she told me she could never love another man that much. I'm not really looking for love. I cannot shake the thoughts of Juliana Kemp. She is, or was, a beautiful girl, like my companion here, and there is a good chance that she is alive and living a life that is indescribable. Arch Swanger is a psychopath, and probably a sociopath, and he would rather lie than tell the truth about anything. But he wasn't lying about young Heather Ferris, late of the village of Lamont, Missouri, a 20-year-old dropout who was working the graveyard shift at a convenience store when she vanished with no clues. They're still combing the woods and bringing in bloodhounds and offering rewards, but nothing has worked so far. How did Swanger know about her? It's possible he caught an early news report, but that's not likely. I went online immediately, found her story, and began following it in the Columbia newspaper. Lamont is over 500 miles away from here, and sadly, she's just another missing girl from a small town. Heather has not made the national news. What if Swanger is telling the truth? That Juliana Kemp and Heather Ferris are two girls out of a dozen who've been kidnapped by a sex trafficking ring and forced to strip, screw, and breed while they live on heroin. The fact that I know this, or at least suspect it, makes me feel like an accomplice. I am not Swanger's lawyer, and I made that very clear. Indeed, I felt a real rush of adrenaline when I gripped my Glock and thought about putting him out of his misery. There are no ethical constraints binding me to silence and confidentiality with this scumbag. And even if there were, I would be inclined to ignore them if doing so might save some girls. I stopped worrying about ethics a long time ago. In my world, my enemies are ruthless. If I make nice, I get crushed. It is now 1 a.m., and I am even wider awake. Naomi rolls over and flings a leg in my direction. I gently stroke her thigh. How can flesh be so smooth? And she whimpers as if somewhere in her deep sleep she likes the touching. I manage to get still and close my eyes. My last thought is of Gillianna Kemp, living in our generation's version of slavery. Chapter 2. Partner and I spend most of Saturday in the basement of the law offices of Harry and Harry, poring over juror questionnaires and ponderous reports put together by Cliff, a jury consultant, who so far has billed me $30,000. The tally for Tadeo's defense is just under $70,000, all from my pocket, of course, and it will continue to climb. He and I have not discussed the payment of fees because it's a waste of time. He's broke, and Miguel and the rest of the drug gang have little interest in my compensation. They figure I made enough money from Tadeo's brief career. I assume they also think that in the rules of the streets, the removal of tubby and razor is worth a bundle. Tit for tat. We're all even. Cliff is of the opinion that the defense of Tadeo Zapata has quite a mountain to climb. He and his firm have done their usual work of, 1, polling 1,000 registered voters in this metropolitan area and asking hypothetical questions, 2, hurriedly researching the backgrounds of all 200 prospective jurors, and 3, reviewing every news report that mentions the ugly incident in which Sean King was beaten. From the poll, an astonishing 31% of those questioned know a little or a lot about the case, and the vast majority of these favor conviction. 18% have seen the video. In the garden variety murder case, regardless of how sensational, finding 10% who are aware of it is unusual. Unlike most consultants, Cliff is known for his bluntness. That's why I use him. His bottom line?
Chances of an acquittal are slim. Chances of a conviction are high. Cut a deal. Negotiate a plea bargain. Run for the hills.
When I first read his report, I called him immediately and said, "Come on, Cliff. I'm paying you all this money, and your best advice is to run for the hills?" He's a real smartass, and his reply was,
"No, actually, I'd sprint for the hills. Your client is toast, and the jury will throw the book at him."
Cliff will be in the courtroom Monday, watching and taking notes. As much as I love the cameras and the attention, I'm not looking forward to it. Chapter 3. At 4 p.m., partner and I climb into my sparkling new, customized Ford cargo van, complete with all the usual finery I need for such a splendid mobile office, and head for the university. At partner's suggestion, I agreed to tone it down, to move away from conspicuous black to more of a soft bronze exterior color. Painted on both sides, in small block letters, are the words, "Smith Contractors," another nice touch partner really wanted. He's convinced that we will now blend in with the world and be harder to spot by the police, Link, my own clients, and all the other bad guys, real and potential, lurking out there. He drops me off in front of the university's aquatic center and leaves in search of a suitable parking place. I drift inside, hear the echoing voices, find the pool, and send a text message to Moss Corgan. Swarms of small, skinny kids are heavily involved in a swim meet. The bleachers are half-packed with noisy parents. A breaststroke race is underway, and little girls splash and kick in all 8 lanes of the 50-meter pool. Moss replies, "Right side, 3rd section, top row." I look and see no one, but I'm sure he's watching. I'm wearing a leather jacket with my long hair under the collar, along with jeans and a blue and orange Mets cap. This is really not my crowd, and I don't expect to be recognized, but I rarely take chances. Just last week, partner and I were having a sandwich in a cafe when a jerk walked over and informed me that, in his opinion, my little cage fighter should rot in jail for the rest of his life. I thanked him and asked him to please leave us alone. He called me a crook. Partner stood, and the guy got lost. As I climb the steps, I get a noseful of the smell of chlorine. Starcher once mentioned swimming, but one of his mothers told him the sport was too dangerous because of all the chemicals they put in the water. I'm surprised they don't keep the kid in a bubble. I sit alone for a moment, far away from anyone else, and watch the action in the pool. The parents yell and the noise gets louder and louder until it suddenly stops and the race is over. The kids pull themselves out of the water as their mothers wait with towels and advice. From here, they appear to be about 10 years old. Moss rises from a group of parents across the pool and slowly walks around it. He climbs the bleachers in front of me and eventually takes a seat, about 3 feet away. His body language says it all. He hates where he is and would rather be talking to a serial killer. "This better be good, Rudd," he says without looking at me. "And hello to you too, Moss. Which one is your kid?" Stupid question. There are about 1,000 of them down there crawling around the pool. "That one," he says with a slight nod. What a smartass. But then I asked for it. "She's a 12-year-old freestyler. Won't get wet for another 30 minutes. Can we get on with this?" "I have another deal for you, and it's even more complicated than the last one." "That's what you said. I almost hung up, Rudd, until you mentioned the Kemp girl. Let's have it." Swanger tracked me down again. We met. He claims to know where she is, that she went full term with the pregnancy, the baby got sold by some traffickers who feed her heroin in exchange for all manner of sexual activities. "Swanger is a proven liar." "He certainly is, but some of what he says is true." "Why did he contact you?" "He says he needs help, and, not surprisingly, he needs money. There's a chance he'll contact me again, and if he does, I can possibly put the police on his trail. That trail might lead to Juliana Kemp, or not. There's no way to know, but right now the police have nothing else."
"So you're sacrificing your client again?"
"He's not my client. I made that clear to him. He may think of me as his lawyer, but it's a waste of time to analyze what Art Swanger might be thinking." A loud buzzer goes off, and 8 boys plunge into the water. Instantly, the parents start yelling, as if the kids can hear them. Other than, "Swim faster!" what can you scream at a splashing kid in the heat of a race? We watch them until they make the turn. Moss says,
"And what do you want from us?"
"I go to trial Monday with my cage fighter. I want a better deal. I want a 5-year plea bargain with a guarantee that he serves his time in the county penal farm. It's a softer place. There's a nice gym. The kid can stay in shape, serve about 18 months, get paroled when he's, say, 24, and still have a future in the ring. Otherwise, he'll serve 15 and come out a hardened street thug with only one thing on his mind: more crime." He's already rolling his eyes. He exhales in disbelief, as if everything I've just said is a complete joke. He shakes his head. I must be an idiot. Finally, with great effort, he manages to say,
"We have no control over the prosecutor. You know that."
"Mancini was appointed by the mayor and confirmed by the city council, same as you. Our interim police chief was appointed by the mayor and confirmed by the city council. Same for Roy Kemp, who's still on leave. Can't we find a way to work together here?"
"Mancini won't listen to Woody. He hates him."
"Everybody hates Woody, and he hates everybody right back. Somehow he's survived 3 terms. Here's how you sell it to Woody. Are you listening?" He has yet to look at me, but now he turns and glares. He looks back at the pool and crosses his arms over his chest, my signal to spill it. "Okay, play along, Moss. Help me walk through this. Let's assume I can lead the cops to Swanger. Assume further that Swanger can lead the cops to Juliana Kemp. Somewhere in West Central Chicago, by the way. Assume they rescue the girl, and guess what? Our beloved mayor, the Honorable L. Woodrow Sullivan III, gets to hold the first press conference. Imagine that scene, Moss. You know how Woody loves a press conference. It will be his finest moment. Woody in a dark suit, all smiles, a row of cops behind him, all grim-faced, but happy because the girl has been saved. Woody makes the announcement as if he personally found her and pulled off the miracle. An hour later, we get our first glimpse of the happy Kemp family reunited, with Woody, of course, wedging himself into the photo as only he can do. What a moment! Moss softens a bit as he absorbs this visual. It rattles around his brain. He wants to dismiss it and tell me to go to hell, but it's simply too rich. Creativity fails him, as usual, so he simply says,
"You're crazy, Rudd."
No surprise. I press on with, "Since we're grasping for the truth here and making bold assumptions, let's say that Swanger is not lying. If so, Juliana is one of many girls snatched from their families and sold into bondage. Almost all are white American girls. If their ring is busted and the traffickers are caught, then the story echoes from coast to coast. Woody gets more than his share of the credit. Certainly enough to shine in this town."
"Mancini will never go along."
"Then fire Mancini, on the spot. Call him on the carpet and force his resignation. The mayor has that power under our version of democracy. Replace him with one of those little ass-kissing bureaucrats. There are only 100 of them."
"I think there are 15, he says.
"Sorry. So out of 15 assistant city prosecutors, I'm sure you and Woody can find one with a bit of ambition, one who'll do what you tell him or her to do in exchange for the big office. Come on, Moss. This is not that complicated." He leans forward, deep in thought, elbows on knees. The noise fades. The crowd goes quiet as one race ends and the next one starts to get organized. Thankfully, I've never been to a swim meet, but it appears as if this ordeal goes on for hours. I thank Starcher's mothers and their fear of chlorine. He needs some help, so I prod on.
"Woody has the power, Moss. He can make this happen."
"Why does it have to be a deal? Why can't you just do the right thing and cooperate with the police? If you believe Swanger, and if he's really not your client, then help out the cops here. Hell, you're talking about an innocent young woman."
"Because I don't work that way," I say, though I've lost sleep trying to answer his question. "I have a client to represent, one who's guilty, as most are, and I'm desperate for ways to help him. I don't get clients who have the potential to make a lot of money, legally, but this kid is different. He could lift himself and his rather large and growing family out of the ghetto."
"A ghetto here is better than where they came from,"
he blurts, and immediately wishes he hadn't said it. Wisely and uncharacteristically, I let it pass. We watch a group of taller boys limber up and stretch nervously at the start. I say, "There's something else."
"Oh, a multi-part deal. What a surprise."
About a month ago, the cops found a couple of bodies at the landfill. Two thugs who worked for Link Scanlon. For some reason, I'm a suspect. Don't know how serious things are, but I'd rather not deal with it.
"I thought Link was your client."
"He was, but let's say that when he vanished, he was less than pleased with my services. He sent the two thugs to squeeze some money out of me."
"Who whacked them?"
"I don't know, but it wasn't me." "Seriously, you think I'd run the risk?"
"Probably."
I snort a cheap laugh.
"No way.
These guys are career goons with lots of enemies. Whoever whacked them comes from a long list of folks who wanted to."
"So, let me get this straight. First, you want the mayor to force Mancini to lighten up on your cage fighter so he can plead to a sweet deal and protect his career. Second, you want the mayor to lean on the police department to look elsewhere for whoever rubbed out Link's boys. And third..."
"What was third?"
"The best part. Swanger."
"Oh, right. And in return for the mayor putting his neck on the block, you might be able to help the police find Swanger, who just might be telling the truth, and who just might be able to lead them to the girl. That right, Rudd?"
"That covers it."
"What a crock of shit,"
I watch him as he walks down the aisle in the bleachers and circles around the far end of the pool. On the other side, he walks up four rows and returns to his seat beside his wife. From far away, I stare at him for a long time, and he never casts even the slightest glance in my direction. Chapter 4 C for Catfish Cave. It's a few miles east of town in a dingy suburb, a bedroom community of tract houses built 60 years ago with materials designed to last 50 years. The restaurant offers bargain buffets of fish and vegetables, all now battered and fried to hell and back, but previously frozen for months, even years. For only $10, the customers can graze and gorge for hours without limits. They heap their platters as if they're starving, and wash it all down with gallons of sugary tea. For some reason, alcohol is served, but people do not come here for the booze. Tucked away in a dark, neglected corner is an empty bar, and it is here that I occasionally meet Nate Spurio. The last time we met, it was B for a bagel shop. The time before, it was A for an Arby's roast beef joint in another suburb. Nate's career hit a dead end a decade ago. He can't be fired, and evidently he can't be promoted. But if by some chance he was spotted having an off-duty drink with me, he would find himself directing traffic in front of an elementary school. He's too honest for police work in this town. His boss is a Captain Truitt, a decent guy who's very close to Roy Kemp. If I want to deliver a message to Kemp, the path begins here over a couple of drinks. I lay it all on the table. Nate is surprised that I hold even the faintest hope that Juliana Kemp is still alive. I assure him that I don't know what to believe, and believing anything Swanger says is probably a mistake. But what is there to lose? He certainly knows something, which is a lot more than our investigators can say. The more we talk and drink, the more Nate is convinced that the police department and its union can pressure both the mayor and Max Mancini. Our former chief of police was an idiot who allowed our force to become what it is, but Roy Kemp is still held in high regard by his brothers. Saving his daughter is worth a reduced plea bargain for every defendant now sitting in jail. I repeatedly caution Nate that finding her is against the odds. First, I'm not sure I can find Swanger, or that he'll want to see me again. The last time we met, I almost shot him. I have the prepaid cell phone, but haven't used it since our last meeting. If it doesn't work, or if he doesn't answer it, then we're out of luck. And if I meet him and the police are able to follow him, what are the odds that he'll lead them to the strip club in West Central Chicago? Pretty slim, I think. Nate has the emotional range of a monk, but he can't hide his excitement. When we leave the bar, he says he's headed to Truitt's house. There they'll talk off the record, and he expects Truitt to immediately inform Roy Kemp that a possible deal is brewing. It's a long shot, but when it's your daughter, you'll try anything. I urge him to hustle up. The trial starts tomorrow. Chapter 5 Late Sunday night, partner and I go to the city jail for the last pre-trial meeting with our client. After half an hour of sniping with the jailers, I'm finally allowed to see Tadeo. The kid frightens me. During his time in jail, he has absorbed a lot of free advice from his new pals, and he's also convinced himself that he's famous. Because of the video, he gets a lot of mail, almost all of it from admirers. He thinks he's about to walk away from the trial a free man, beloved by many and ready to continue his brilliant career. I've tried to bring him back to reality and convince him that the people writing him letters are not necessarily the same type of people who will be sitting in the jury box. The letter writers are from the fringe. Several have even proposed marriage. The jurors will be registered voters from our community, few of whom have any fondness for cage fighting. As always, I pass along the latest plea offer of 15 years for second-degree murder. He laughs with a cocky smirk, same as before. He doesn't ask for my advice, and I don't offer it. He's turned down 15 years so many times, it's not worth discussing. Wisely, he has followed my advice and shaved and trimmed his hair. I've brought along a second-hand navy suit with a white shirt and tie, an outfit his mother found at Goodwill. On his neck, below his left ear, is a tattoo of some baffling origin, and it will be partially visible above his collar. Since most of my clients have tattoos, I deal with this issue all the time. It's best to keep them away from the jurors. In Tadeo's case, though, our jurors will be treated to his astonishing display of ink when they see the video. Evidently, when a guy makes the decision to become a cage fighter, his first stop on the way to the gym is the tattoo parlor. There's a gap between us that's been growing for some time. He thinks he'll walk. I think he'll go to prison. He sees my doubts of a successful outcome as not only a lack of confidence in him, but also in my own ability in the courtroom. What's really bothersome is his insistence on testifying. He truly believes he can take the stand and con the jury into believing, one, the fight was stolen from him by Sean King, and two, he snapped, attacked, blacked out, and went temporarily insane, and three, now feels real bad about it. After he explains everything to the jury, he wants to make a dramatic, emotional apology to the King family. Then all will be well, and the jury will rush back with the proper verdict. I have attempted to describe the rough treatment he'll get when I turn him over to Max Mancini for a bit of cross-examination. But, as usual, he has no appreciation for what happens in the heat of a trial. Hell, I'm not always sure what's about to happen. None of my warnings register with Tadeo. He tasted enough glory in the cage to know what's out there. Money, fame, adulation, women, a big house for his mother and family. It will all be his soon enough. Chapter 6. It's impossible to sleep the night before a jury trial opens. My brain is in a state of hyped-up overdrive as I struggle to remember and organize details, facts, things to do. My stomach roils with anxiety and my nerves are frayed and popping. I know it's important to rest and appear fresh and relaxed before the jury, but the truth is, I look the same as always. Tired, stressed, eyes bloodshot. I sip coffee just before dawn and, as usual, ask myself why I do this. Why do I subject myself to such unpleasantness? I have a distant cousin who's a great neurosurgeon in Boston, and I often think about him at moments like this. I suppose his world is quite tense as he cuts into the brain, with so much at stake. How does he handle it physically? The nerves, the butterflies, yes, even diarrhea and nausea. We rarely speak, so I've never inquired. I remind myself that he does his job without an audience, and if he makes a mistake, he simply buries it. I try not to remind myself that he makes $1 million a year. In many ways, a trial lawyer is like an actor on stage. His lines are not always scripted, and that makes his job harder. He has to react, to be quick on his feet and with his tongue, to know when to attack and when to shut up. When to lead and when to follow, when to flash anger and when to be cool. Through it all, he has to convince and persuade because nothing matters but the jury's final vote. I eventually forget about sleep and go to the pool table. I rack the balls and break them gently. I run the table and drop the 8-ball into a side pocket. I have a collection of brown suits, and I carefully select one for opening day. I wear brown not because I like the color, but because no one else does. Lawyers, as well as bankers and executives and politicians, all believe that dress suits should be either navy or dark gray. Shirts are either white or light blue. Ties, some variety of red. I never wear those colors. Instead of black shoes, today I'll wear ostrich skin cowboy boots. They don't really match my brown suit, but who cares? With my ensemble laid out on the bed, I take a long shower. In my bathrobe, I pace around the den, delivering at low volume another version of my opening statement. I break another rack, miss the first three shots, and lay down my cue stick. Chapter 7. The courtroom is packed by 9 a.m., the appointed hour for all 200 potential jurors to show up and get processed. And since capacity is only 200, there is gridlock when a horde of spectators and a few dozen reporters also show up and jockey for position. Max Mancini struts about in his finest navy suit and sparkling black wingtips, flashing smiles at the clerks and assistants. With all these people watching, he's even nice to me. We huddle and chat importantly as the bailiffs deal with the throng. "Still 15 years?" I ask.
"You got it,"
he says, smiling and looking at the audience. Obviously, between Moss and Spurio, the word has not yet made its way to Max's ears. Or maybe it has. Maybe Max was told to cut a deal and get a plea, and maybe Max did what I would expect him to do, told Woody and Moss and Kemp and everybody else to go to hell. This is his show, a big moment in his career. Just look at all those folks out there admiring him, and all those reporters. Presiding this week is the Honorable Janet Fabineau, quietly known among the lawyers as Go Slow Fabineau. She's a young judge, still a bit on the green side, but maturing nicely on the bench. She's afraid to make mistakes, so she's very deliberate. And slow. She talks slow, thinks slow, rules slow, and she insists that the lawyers and witnesses speak clearly at all times. She pretends this is for the benefit of the court reporter who must take down every word, but we suspect it's really because Her Honor also absorbs things real slow. Her clerk appears and says the judge wants to see the lawyers in chambers. We file in and take seats around an old work table, me on one side, Mancini and his flunky on the other. Janet sits at one end, eating slices of apple from a plastic bowl. They say she's always fussing over her latest diet and her latest trainer, but I've noticed no progress on the reduction front. Mercifully, she does not offer us any of her food. "Any more pretrial motions?" she asks as she looks at me. Chomp, chomp. Mancini shakes his head no. I do the same and add, for reasons that are solely antagonistic, "Wouldn't do any good." I've filed dozens, and they've all been overruled. She absorbs this cheap shot, swallows hard, takes a sip of what looks like early morning urine, and says, "Any chance of a plea bargain?" Mancini says, "We're still offering 15 years on a second degree." I say, "And my client still says no. Sorry." "Not a bad offer," she says, slinging a cheap shot back at me. "What would the defendant take?" "I don't know, Your Honor. At this point, I'm not sure he's willing to plead guilty to anything. Things might change after a day or two of trial, but right now, he's looking forward to his day in court." "Very well. We can certainly accommodate him." We talk about this and that and kill time while the bailiffs process the jurors and get things organized. Finally, at 10:30, the clerk says the courtroom is ready. The lawyers leave and take their places. I sit next to Tadeo, who looks a bit awkward all dressed up. We whisper, and I assure him things are going swell, just as I expected, so far anyway. Behind us, the prospective jurors stare at the back of his head and wonder what awful crime he has committed. When instructed, we all rise in deference to the court as Judge Fabineau enters, her bulky figure nicely camouflaged by the long black robe. Because so much of their dreary work is done without an audience, judges love crowded courtrooms. They are the supreme rulers over everything in sight, and they like to be appreciated. Some tend to grandstand, and I'm curious to see how Janet conducts herself with so many watching. She welcomes everyone to the proceedings, explains why we're all here, rambles on a bit too long, and finally asks Tadeo to stand and face the crowd. He does so, smiles as I instructed him to do, then sits down. Janet introduces Mancini and me. I simply stand and nod. He stands and grins and sort of opens his arms as if welcoming the people into his domain. His phoniness is hard to stomach. The jurors have now been numbered, and Fabineau asks those holding 101 through 198 to leave the courtroom and take a break. Call the clerk at 1 p.m. and see if you're needed. Half of them file out, some in a hurry, some actually smiling at their luck. On one side of the courtroom, the bailiffs place the remaining prospects in rows of 10, and we get our first look at the likely jurors. This drags on for an hour, and Taddeo whispers that he's bored. I ask him if he prefers staying in jail. No, he does not. The pool is purged of those over the age of 65 and those with doctor's excuses. The 92 we are now staring at are ready to be examined. Fabineau breaks for lunch, and we're told to be back at 2 p.m. Taddeo asks if there's any chance of a proper lunch in a nice restaurant. I smile and say no. He's headed back to the jail. As I huddle with Cliff, the jury consultant, a uniformed bailiff approaches and asks, "Are you Mr. Rudd?" I nod, and he hands me some papers. Domestic Relations Court. A summons for an emergency hearing to terminate all parental rights. I curse under my breath, walk to the jury box, and take a seat. That bitch, Judith, has waited until this moment to further complicate matters. I read on, and my shoulders begin to sag. Yesterday, Sunday, was my day to spend with Starcher. 12 hours, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. A modified verbal agreement between Judith and me. Being preoccupied with the trial, I of course forgot about this and stiffed my kid. In Judith's twisted way of thinking, this is clear proof that I'm an unfit father and should be completely banished from my son's life. She demands an emergency hearing, as if Starcher is in imminent danger, and if one is granted, it will be the fourth in the past 3 years. She's 0 for 3, and she's perfectly willing to go 0 for 4 to prove something. What? I don't know. I buy a once-frozen fresh sandwich out of a machine and stroll down to domestic relations. Machine food is often underrated. Carla, a deputy clerk I once hit on, pulls the file and we look it over, our heads just inches apart. When I hit on her about 2 years ago, she was in a relationship, whatever the hell that means. What it really meant was that she had no interest in me. I took it in stride. I've had my balls busted so many times, I'm surprised when a woman says, maybe. Anyway, Carla must be out of her relationship because she's all smiles and come-ons, which is not that unusual among the army of deputy clerks and secretaries and receptionists who clog these offices and hallways. A single straight male lawyer with a little cash and a nice suit gets plenty of looks from the unmarried ladies, and from some of the married ones as well. If I played the game, had the time and interest, I could run these gals into the ground. Carla, though, has chubbed up considerably in recent months and is not looking nearly as good as before. She says,
"Judge Stanley Leaf."
"Same one as last time," I reply. I'm surprised he's still alive.
"Looks like your ex is a tough one."
That's a huge understatement.
"She's in here from time to time. Not very friendly."
I thank her, and as I'm leaving, she says,
"Call me sometime."
I want to say, "Well, if you'll hit the gym for about 6 months, then I'll take a look and consider it." Instead, and because I'm such a gentleman, I say, "Sure." Judge Stanley Leaf stiff-armed Judith in her last effort to strip me of parental rights. He had no patience with her and ruled on the spot in my favor. The fact that she rolled the dice with this latest filing and got stuck with Leaf again says a lot about her integrity and her naivete. In my world, if the case is critical, and what could be more drastic than cutting off a respectable father's right to see his child, all measures must be taken to ensure a fair hearing before the proper judge. This might require the filing of a motion to ask an unwanted judge to step aside. it might require a complaint with the State Board of Judicial Ethics. My preferred method, though, is simply a cash bribe to the right clerk. Judith would never consider any of these tactics. Thus, she stuck with Leif again. I remind myself that this is not about winning or losing, not about this judge or that one. It's nothing but abuse of the court system to harass a former spouse. She has no worries about legal fees. She has no fears of retribution. She roams this section of the old courthouse every day, so this is her turf. I find a bench and read her petition as I finish my sandwich. Chapter 8. For the afternoon session, we move our chairs to the other side of our tables and stare directly at the jurors. And they stare at us as if we're aliens. Under Fabineau's selection scheme, and every trial judge is given great leeway in devising methods to pick juries, those with numbers 1 through 40 are seated in the first four rows, and from there we'll likely find our final 12. So we zero in on them as Her Honor rambles on about the civic importance of jury service. Of the first 40, there are 25 whites, 8 blacks, 5 Hispanics, 1 young lady from Vietnam, and another one from India. 22 females, 18 males. Thanks to Cliff and his team, I know their names, addresses, vocations, marital situations, church memberships, and history.